Today is Wednesday, November 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. World leaders agreed to new rules on preserving forests at the UN Climate Conference.
We are committed to eliminating illegal deforestation by 2030. I call on every country to help defend all forests.
A UN youth leader on climate change hasn't been able to talk to family or friends since Sudan's military takeover.
I don't know how is my family and friends are doing because currently they cut the internet, they also cut their communication.
And a top U.S. diplomat urges Sudan's military leaders to return the country to its transitional government. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday announced ambitious climate commitments at the United Nations Climate Change Conference, also known as COP26, in Glasgow, Scotland. He also slammed Chinese and Russian leaders for not doing their part. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wittakuswara has this report from Glasgow.
Stopping deforestation and restoring 200 million hectares of forests and other ecosystems by the year 2030, backed by close to $20 billion in public and private funding. That's the pledge made by more than 100 world leaders at COP26, the UN climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro spoke via video link.
We are committed to eliminating illegal deforestation by 2030. I call on every country to help defend all forests, including with adequate resources for the benefit of all.
Methane emissions coming mainly from industries such as oil, gas, and coal will also be slashed. Leaders committed to cut levels 30% by 2030 under the Global Methane Pledge, an initiative pushed by the U.S. and European Union.
So cutting back on methane emissions is one of the most effective things we can do to reduce near-term global warming and keep 1.5 degrees Celsius. It is the lowest hanging fruit.
With prospects for his climate legislation uncertain in Congress, U.S. President Joe Biden unveiled a series of domestic initiatives to support the deforestation and methane pledge. He slammed China and Russia for not doing their part.
But the fact that China, trying to assert, understandably, a new role in the world as a world leader, not showing up, come on. The single most important thing that's gotten the attention of the world is climate. Everywhere. From Iceland to Australia it just is a gigantic issue. And they've walked away. How do you do that and claim to be able to have any leadership mantle? The same with Putin and Russia.
China and Russia reject the accusation and say Western industrialized nations are the ones who need to do more since they are responsible for most of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere today. Both countries have aimed to cut emissions by net zero by 2060, a decade after the global target. But they did commit to end deforestation.
We take the strongest and most vigorous measures to conserve it. We improve forest management and fight illegal logging and forest fires. We are expanding reforestation areas. We have been consistently increasing funding for these purposes.
Climate activists welcome the commitments but are still skeptical.
This is the problem with a lot of these commitments. There is an accountability gap. Governments made similar pledges in 2014 with the New York Declaration on Forests, but they didn't lead to anywhere near the progress that was expected.
COP26 negotiations will continue until November 12th, but one major proposal, ending coal dependency, was dead on arrival. At the G20 summit in Rome last week, leaders of the 20 largest economies could not agree on when to phase out this dirty source of energy that accounts for more than 70% of greenhouse emissions. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News, Glasgow, Scotland.
African nations at the COP26 summit have criticized rich countries for failing to meet their promise of giving billions of dollars to help them cope with climate change. But agreements to protect rainforests and slash methane emissions were welcomed, as Henry Ridgewell reports from the conference in Glasgow.
The world's wealthiest nations, the G20, account for 80% of greenhouse gas emissions. But scientists say poorer countries, particularly in Africa, are suffering the worst impacts of climate change. rich nations pledged in 2009 to give developing countries $100 billion a year to help them deal with climate change. But the target date has been put back to 2023. At the COP26 summit Tuesday, African leaders voiced their anger.
Those same nations are, however, insisting that we abandon the opportunity for rapid development of our economies. That would be tantamount to enshrining in the global community inequality of the highest order.
Their appeals failed to shift the timetable. But the frustration was tempered by progress on other vital climate emergencies. Over 100 nations agreed to end deforestation by 2030, backed by close to $20 billion in public and private funding. The signatories included Brazil. Deforestation has increased in the Amazon under Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro to its highest level in a decade, and some are skeptical of his pledge.
Mas isso não vai resolver o problema.
It won't solve social problems in our community where there is no water, where there is deforestation, where there is a river contamination. These are investments that will only give free rein to companies to keep their polluting.
Over 100 countries also signed a global methane pledge to cut emissions by 30% by 2030. Methane is 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide in driving global warming.
It's an incredibly important progress in addressing the climate crisis, because we can now think about methane emissions separately from CO2 and recognizing that reduction of methane represents an enormous lever for making progress in reducing the rate of warming.
China and Russia, two of the world's biggest methane emitters, did not sign.
There may be no big breakthrough on cutting overall emissions at this summit, but organisers say the targeted agreements on protecting rainforests, cutting methane, or protecting vulnerable island states all add up to significant progress.
The absence of the Chinese, Russian, and Brazilian presidents has led to questions over how effective the summit will be in curbing global warming. Host British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said he was cautiously optimistic. World leaders have now returned home. Their teams of negotiators will now decide the fate of the summit, and many scientists say the future of planet Earth. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News at the COP26 summit, Glasgow.
The Sudanese Prime Minister wants detainees released and governing bodies restored before he will enter into any talks with military leaders who orchestrated a coup last week. That's according to the office of Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, who was ousted during the coup. Hamdok has been under house arrest since his government was toppled on October 25th by Military Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, which derailed the transitional government that was heading towards civilian rule. Western powers, including the U.S., responded by freezing aid to Sudan. Nisreen El-Sayem, chair of the UN Secretary General's Youth Advisory Group on Climate Change, says she's not been able to get in touch with either her family or friends since the military takeover in Sudan because communications have been cut off. El-Sayem, who is in Scotland attending that same climate conference this week, tells me Sudanese people around the world are hoping and praying that the civilian-led transitional government will soon be restored.
I don't know how is my family and friends are doing because currently they cut the internet. They also cut the communication, so I cannot call them. I cannot WhatsApp them, and there's no way of communicating.
Are you hopeful that the military will walk it back and that the civilian-led government will be restored?
Yes, it will not be easy. It will be a very long fight, very hard, very aggressive. From their side, of course, as Sudanese people, we stick with our peaceful revolution. And it unfortunately, it will turn bloody, as the very small experience they have about dictatorship and militaries. The only language they understand is blood, unfortunately. But it will happen at the end, and I really hope and pray that it happens with less losses. We cannot afford losing more young people or losing more population. We are already very exhausted by the wars that we were part of for many, many years.
Are you worried that the more the days go by and the power-sharing government has not been restored, that things are going to remain more or less in place as they are now?
Yes, and then they will start to normalize it to the international community and normalize it to the people, and then the cycle goes on.
That sounds like a pretty gloomy outlook.
Yeah, I really don't know what to think or to feel about this kind of situation, especially that I never thought of being a diaspora or living outside of the country, because I'm a Sudanese person who loves to be inside of Sudan. But I'm really considering this option right now, and it's not easy to just feel that all of the plans you had for the rest of your life is gone with the wind.
And by that, do you mean you're considering the option of not returning home?
Yes, because it's not safe out there for all of the activists, and they already arrested a lot of people. Most of my friends are arrested now, according to some news we get leaked out. And yes, I hope and I pray that things go well. There's a lot of work we started to do in Sudan. You cannot imagine how hopeful young people were, how much hard they worked, and how much they sacrificed it to have this transitional government and the transition period goes very well and have a civilian government and then an election, and then we have to build the democratic country we hope for. And it's just heartbreaking, not only heartbreaking, but hope-breaking also to see how things turned off. But I think the situation in Sudan, the spirit there is by far higher than the spirit I have right now. It's maybe because it's the first time such a big event happened in Sudan and I'm outside. But the rest of the young people around Sudan, they are very much determined that they will not surrender, and they will continue to do the work they're trying to do.
That is Nisreen El-Saim, a Sudanese citizen, speaking with me earlier this week from the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow. El-Saim is the chairperson of the UN Secretary General's Youth Advisory Group on Climate Change. The U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa says the United States will continue to engage with both civilian and military leaders in Sudan to return the government to its transitional government. Jeffrey Feltman told journalists in a news conference on Tuesday that despite General Alburnham's statements that he would proceed with plans for elections and adhere to some elements of the 2019 constitutional document, his actions are doing the opposite.
To those freedom-loving Sudanese, and to those who would seek to rob them of their democratic ambition, I say that the world is watching. The Sudanese people have made clear that they will not accept the military's attempts to sideline their hard-fought democratic transition, and we stand with the people of Sudan.
Feltman said Washington is working with partners such as the European Union, the African Union, the UN, and the League of Arab States to help restore Sudan's government. He was speaking to the news conference by telephone from Washington. You're listening to VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Carol Van Dam. Hundreds of thousands of Afghan girls and young women have not been allowed to return to their studies since the Taliban seized power in mid-August. Many say their dreams are on hold, and few have hope for the future. Reuters correspondent Flora Bradley Watson has more.
17-year-old Saha looks round her old, empty classroom. The Afghan teenager dreams of becoming an engineer, but for now at least, she has to learn at home. Like hundreds of thousands of other Afghan girls and young women, she has not been allowed to return to her studies since the Taliban seized power in mid-August. The hardline group has only allowed boys and younger girls back to class.
When I see my younger sister and brother who go to school, I feel very sad for myself that I can't study. They, for example, come home and do their homework, talk about their classmates and their studies, but I feel sad inside that I can't go to school myself.
Across town, Hawa's dreams are also on hold. The university student has not been able to return to her studies of Russian literature. Most public universities are not functioning at all, or only partially. On top of this, weeks after taking power, the Taliban closed the women's ministry, replacing it with a ministry for virtue and vice. Hawa says she has no hope for the future.
When the women's ministry was shut down, when we went to protest, the Taliban told us, "Who are you? Your only role is to cook, get married, and sit at home. You don't need to work anymore."
When Taliban Islamists were in power from 1996 to 2001, girls were not allowed to attend school and women were banned from work. Officials have tried to assure Afghans and foreign donors that people's rights will be honored this time round. They've promised to allow girls to go to school and women to study and work once details on how to do so in accordance with Islamic law are worked out. They have also blamed the international community for cutting off aid, making it harder to fund the reopening of schools and universities for all. But this is of little solace to Saha, who is stuck at home frustrated and worried about what future lies ahead.
That is Reuters correspondent Flora Bradley Watson reporting. Republicans swept statewide races in the U.S. state of Virginia in Tuesday's off-year election. Former business executive Glenn Youngkin won the governor's race, a major political turnabout in a state that increasingly had been favoring the Democratic Party. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
All righty, Virginia, we won this thing!
The 54-year-old political newcomer beat Democrat Terry McAuliffe, who served as governor from 2014 to 2018. Youngkin told supporters he plans to cut taxes, invest in education and law enforcement.
Together, we will change the trajectory of this Commonwealth.
The win has alarmed Democrats, already nervous about holding their party's narrow control of Congress in next year's midterm elections. President Biden won Virginia by a comfortable 10 percentage points last year. I'm Julie Walker.
Democratic Party candidate Eric Adams, a former police officer, is now New York City's new mayor. Following Tuesday's election, which had been heavily favored to win, Adams becomes the second African-American mayor of the city and another example of how the Democratic Party dominates the city's politics. VOA's Jay Susiman Oni reports.
Heavily favored to win, Democrat and former New York City police captain Eric Adams is a moderate who has promised to usher the city into a new era of safety and economic recovery.
Because I'm standing here, everyday New York is going to realize that they deserve the right to stand in the city.
That's
also.
Right.
Yes.
Right. This is for the little guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
It's for the little guy.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
Overwhelmed.
The 61-year-old Adams served as an NYPD officer for more than 20 years, rising to the rank of captain while speaking out against police brutality and racism within the department. He turned to politics after retiring from law enforcement, serving four terms as a state senator and later as Brooklyn's borough president. A victim of police abuse at 15, Adams has called for criminal justice reform.
Both the reformers see me as one of theirs, and the police see me as one of theirs. Very unique place I am.
The ex-cop turned politician has denounced calls to defund the police, towing a moderate line which political analysts say worked in his favor.
People understand that there has to be reforms in the police department, but most people in the city want to see the crime rate come down again. There's proliferation of guns and gangs, and that isn't good for the people who live here. That's not good for the economy. That's just simply not good for the future of the city, no matter what race you are. And Eric Adams seems to understand this very well, and I think that was the key to his victory.
With New York having been the early epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic, Adams will be tasked with leading the city's economic recovery while also battling surging crime and homelessness.
The economy was devastated. We still haven't come back. He's got to reassure the business community that it's safe to be back and doing business in the city.
Adams' Republican opponent was radio talk show host Curtis Liwa, founder of the Guardian Angels Crime Prevention Group, whose chances were very slim, given that the city's registered Democrats outnumber Republicans 7-1. Adams will become the second African-American after the late David Dinkins to serve as New York City's mayor when he is sworn into office on January 1st. Jason Semelny,
VOA News.
The U.S. is about to start giving COVID-19 vaccines to children aged 5 to 11 on Wednesday. Some 28 million school-age kids are now eligible for the shots that provide protection against the virus. On Tuesday, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control recommended the Pfizer shot for broad use among young children after a panel of outside advisors voted in favor of it. About 55% of Americans are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, but children under 12 have not been eligible for shots until now. The UN Human Rights Chief says Ethiopia's year-long war has been marked by what she calls extreme brutality, as a joint investigation into alleged atrocities blames all sides for committing abuses against civilians. Michelle Bachelet says the big number of violations are associated with Ethiopian forces and those from neighboring Eritrea. The investigation was hampered by authorities' intimidation tactics and restrictions. The UN report also says authorities did not visit some of the war's worst affected areas. The report is a rare collaboration between the UN Human Rights Office and the government-created Ethiopian Human Rights Commission. It comes a day before the one-year mark of the war. Rival Tigray forces continue to threaten the capital. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the governor of South Kivu province says six rebels, two policemen, and a soldier were killed when an armed group raided the eastern town of Bukavu. He said an armed group targeted several police stations in the raid Wednesday. Officials say they are working to identify the attackers. The region's military commander said the group tried to free members which the police had arrested several days ago. Police showed off men they described as rebels, as well as 14 seized weapons. Most of the captives were young, barefoot, and wearing civilian clothes. Industry statistics appear to show that lobster producers in Australia are selling millions of dollars worth of the crustaceans to China, despite Beijing's unofficial trade restrictions. Experts say fishing companies are taking advantage of so-called gray channels. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The AUKUS alliance and Australia's cancellation of a lucrative defence contract in favour of US-built nuclear submarines caught Paris off guard. France felt betrayed. In protest, France temporarily recalled its ambassadors from Washington and Canberra. Tensions remain. French President Emmanuel Macron told reporters at the meeting of the G20 grouping of industrialised nations that Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison had been deceitful, despite the two countries enjoying a close relationship.
When we have respect, we have to behave in line and consistently with this value.
Do you think he lied to you?
I don't think. I know.
Morrison quickly denied he had lied. He insisted he had explained to Macron in June that the submarines to be supplied by French company Naval Group weren't going to meet Australia's military requirements.
I was very clear that what was going to be provided to us was not going to meet our strategic interest.
News reports in Australia have described the dispute between Australia and France as a diplomatic disaster for Canberra and that the damage looks uncontrollable. Australian opposition Senator Penny Wong, the shadow foreign affairs minister, believes Australia has been embarrassed by the French president's allegations.
We've got a reputation as a nation for being straight shooters. That's Australia's reputation internationally. We do what we say. Mr. Morrison's failure to be upfront, his failure to, as President Macron says, tell the truth, is damaging our interests.
Mark Kenny is a professor at the Australian Studies Institute at the Australian National University. He says rarely are world leaders so openly criticised by their peers.
This was really quite a rare level of candour that we see, and a very abrupt denunciation of the integrity of a fellow world leader by Emmanuel Macron. And I thought that was extraordinary.
US President Joe Biden also conceded that the United States was clumsy in its negotiations for a new alliance with Britain and Australia, which cost France billions of dollars. The AUKUS pact will allow Australia to become only the seventh country to have nuclear-powered submarines. The new fleet isn't expected to be in service for decades, forcing Australia to potentially lease or buy vessels from the United States or Britain in the meantime. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA News. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha and the entire production team, thank you for joining us today. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.